The National Archives spent more than $1 million in a legal battle to keep correspondence between former Governor-General Sir John Kerr and the Queen a secret. The so-called palace letters were finally made public in July last year, remember, providing, or was it July this year? July. The years are just fading into
July
one at the moment. Thank you, Paul. Providing a new insight into Gough Whitlam's dismissal in 1975. While the letters confirmed that the Queen wasn't informed about the governor before the Governor-General acted, the role of the monarchy in Australia's greatest constitutional crisis continues to be a matter for debate. Two books have been published with different interpretations of the palace letters. The first is by the Whitlam biographer, Jenny Hocking, who led the fight for access to those letters. The second is by the Australian newspapers Paul Kelly and Troy Bramson. Paul Kelly joins me now in the breakfast studio. Paul, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Fran.
We will come to the palace letters in a moment, but I need to ask you first about the US election result. Joe Biden's claimed victory with a message of healing and unity, but just look at the numbers. He's inherited a deeply divided America. Paul, what's the danger in that for America and for the rest of the world, for Australia?
Well, first of all, this is a profoundly historical event. This is a comfortable win by Joe Biden. It's not a landslide, but it is a comfortable win. Donald Trump has been kept to being a one-term president. I think that's very significant. Trump is now gone. He's been rejected by the American public. It's true that Biden faces an immensely difficult task, running a divided country. He'll probably have a divided administration. And frankly, he'll have a divided Democratic Party as well between the centrists and the progressives. So we shouldn't think that the American trauma can be healed by one election and one term. That won't happen. But a new president offers a new opportunity. America has got a new chance. And personally, I'm very grateful for that.
It'll be interesting to see what the mood of America's heart is, if you like, is if they want to change, if they want to heal, or if those circumstances that led to the election of Trump and the sort of that sentiment of draining the swamp and giving the average guy a go, whether that is still so deeply entrenched.
Well, it is deeply entrenched, but what Biden's got to try and do, and clearly he's signalled this already, he's got to try and govern from the centre. He's got to rebuild the centre of American politics and the centre of American life.
The backbone, he called it, didn't he?
Well, he called it the backbone. He talked about looking after the middle class. This is very good. Now, it's one thing to say it. It's far more difficult to do it. But I think his message of unity and healing is undoubtedly the right message. I think while the country's divided, there will be a lot of goodwill towards Biden.
Let's go to our own constitutional crisis. It was Jenny Hocking's dogged pursuit that lifted the veil of secrecy over what we now know as the palace letters. And she found they revealed, quote, a deeply disturbing level of political engagement between the Queen's private secretary, Martin Charteris, and Sir John Kerr. That's the monarch's right-hand man, that the monarch's right-hand man fostered and supported John Kerr's actions. You have a different interpretation of those letters, don't you?
Well, there was certainly a deep engagement between the Governor-General and Buckingham Palace, between Sir John Kerr and the Queen's private secretary, Sir Martin Charteris. But having read the 212 letters very, very carefully, it's very clear to me that there was no desire on the part of the palace, no policy attitude, no policy on the part of the palace to have Mr. Whitlam removed or have Mr. Whitlam dismissed. The palace didn't have that attitude. They didn't encourage dismissal. And when you think about it, this is no surprise. I mean, the Queen has been on the throne for 68 years. She's never had any attitude on any of the countries where she's head of state of intervening to liquidate prime ministers she doesn't like. So I think this is the key point to make. The palace was not involved in removing Gough Whitlam. And beyond that, the Governor-General, while he cultivated the palace in his letters and raised options, was very, very meticulous. He did not tell the palace that he decided to dismiss Mr. Whitlam. He did not tell the palace that he had any intention to dismiss Mr. Whitlam. And he never gave the palace any indications of this extraordinary plan that he devised, engineered, and implemented on the 11th of November.
He might not have told the palace, but was it clear? I mean, Labor leader Anthony Albanese is in no doubt. He tells you in the book that the letters gave Kerr the comfort he needed to take the extraordinary step of sacking Whitlam. He talked about the reserve powers. He sort of agreed they were there. And Anthony Albanese also points out the palace failed to advise Whitlam that it was in discussions with the Governor-General about the fate of the government. I mean, is that silence defensible, do you believe?
Well, Anthony Albanese has misconstrued what happened. Perhaps he should go back and read the letters. His comments are not well informed and they're not factually based. Now, the point to make here is in relation to the reserve powers. There was some advice given by the palace in relation to the reserve powers, and the clear interpretation of this advice is that Sir Martin Charteris was warning John Kerr against intervention. Charteris said the reserve powers, the great value of the reserve powers is their non-use. That is, you invoke the reserve powers when a Governor-General wants to warn a Prime Minister. Charteris said the reserve power should be used only as a last resort. He said the crisis was not yet a constitutional crisis. He said, in particular, the reserve power should only be used, quote, when there is demonstrably no other course, unquote. Now, the fact of the matter is, there's always another course. The other course is to warn the Prime Minister. This letter of the 4th of November has only one interpretation. It's quite unambiguous. The palace was warning the Governor-General against the use of the reserve powers.
Okay, what about Prince Charles? Because you have brought to light some correspondence between Sir John Kerr and Prince Charles. I'll ask you where that came from, why that wasn't part of the palace papers in a moment. But in that, Prince Charles writes to John Kerr, quote, what you did last year was right and the courageous thing to do, and most Australians seem to endorse your decision when it came to the point. Isn't that the palace directly involving itself and giving this imprimatur to what Sir John Kerr did?
It's a delightful letter, isn't it?
It is it's a surprising letter.
It's a delightful handwritten letter.
And I wonder what it might mean for Prince Charles if he ever becomes our monarch.
Well, I think that's a very interesting question. Now, look, the point to make here is that John Kerr couldn't get directly to the Queen. What he did was he cultivated the Prince. He cultivated the Prince for a long period of time on a range of issues. Indeed, he even told the Prince on a few occasions that if the Prince wanted to become Governor General, and he knew the Prince did, that he, John Kerr, would stand aside for him. So Kerr's cultivation of Prince Charles is truly extraordinary. The key point to make and understand is that Charles is not the monarch, Charles is not Buckingham Palace, Charles is not a decision maker, Charles is separate from the palace, and this letter that we got from the archives is not part of the Buckingham Palace letters.
No.
It's not part of the official correspondence. This is a personal handwritten letter that Charles writes to John Kerr in March 1977, saying to Kerr, I think what you did was the right thing to do and the courageous thing to do. Now, this is Charles as a young man, frankly, I think, a very unwise young man, to a certain extent seduced by John Kerr. It's a very unwise letter. Charles will have to live with the consequences of this letter, but that is not the attitude of the Queen or the palace.
It's an extraordinary letter. It obviously took Jenny Hocking by surprise too, because it wasn't part of the National Archives collection. How did you get it? And does it raise the question whether there's other letters out there between John Kerr and members of the royal family?
Well, we got it because we asked the archives for it, and we got new documents for this book, not just the Buckingham Palace letters. I mean, while the bulk of the book deals with the Buckingham Palace letters, there are other material from the archives we requested a long time ago, and as this material becomes available, then we've incorporated that in the book as well. We've got some very significant new material from the archives, which was not in the Buckingham Palace letters because they were not part of that official correspondence.
And you've also got a foreword or an introduction by Paul Keating too, and you've got interviews with Dame Quentin Bryce and Sir Peter Cosgrove, two GGs too, talking about the role of the Governor-General. Paul, congratulations on all of that.
Thanks
that
so much, Graham.
It's quite interesting to see what you've unearthed there. Can I just turn to another issue? Yesterday we had Malcolm Turnbull and Kevin Rudd on Insiders talking about the influence of the Media Murdoch outlets on on Australia's policy, really, and Australia's politics. They're calling for a royal commission into the Murdoch media empire, but really the lack of ownership diversity in Australia. Do you think that we do need to have some kind of inquiry into diversity in the Australian media?
Well, the point I'd make about this is that in relation to the royal commission, I mean, there's not going to be a royal commission because neither the government or the Labor Party supports it. I don't think a royal commission is the way to go. The interesting point to make about Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull is, and, you know, I say this with a degree of sympathy, they have grievances as prime ministers. And they are now talking about policies that they were not prepared to implement as prime minister. Indeed, they seem to be advocating some sort of policy change contrary to the policies that they actually presided over as prime ministers. Now, there's a lot to say about the media. I guess what I'd say is this. The central challenge in the media today is not the Murdoch media. The central challenge is the new big tech companies in terms of what they represent for the health of the public, the social order, the quality of debate, and the future of democracy. That is the central issue. That's the issue that we need to address. I understand Kevin Rudd and Malcolm Turnbull complaining about fairness by the Murdoch media, but there's also a case about fairness by all media. We've had a recent poll published in the United States by the Pew Research Organization showing two-thirds of Americans are worried about a biased media. This is a problem with the media industry generally. It's not just a problem of one company. And we need to be very careful about former prime ministers who have a grievance, whether it's legitimate or not, presenting a new media policy based upon an attack on one company. That is not the way to conduct media policy in this country.
And just a postscript to that, you talk about the shift to the tech giants. Malcolm Turnbull also talked about the impact of social media on changing our media. And in that interview I'm talking about on Insiders, he talked about our mainstream media in terms of the Murdoch newspapers shifting towards more partisan attacks. You're editor at large at The Australian. Do you think there's been a shift towards more partisan attacks?
Listen, if we want to have a serious debate about the media, then let's be dispassionate and recognise the central point here. The business model of all media organisations these days is based partly on political constituencies. That is, we're the ones talking about the New York Times, Fox News, the Financial Times of London, the BBC, the ABC, the Australian, the Telegraph. Every media organisation cultivates a particular political constituency. Now, that is the reality of the modern media. Now, there are dangers and there are risks in this in terms of the fracturing of society and political polarisation. But that is the reality. Now, let's have a debate about the media. Fine. But let's have a debate about the media which recognises what is going on in the modern media and the way the modern media is being transformed by stresses and strains on the business model and changes in the nature of society, which means media are identifying themselves and playing more and more to their own political constituencies.
Paul Kelly, thank you very much for joining us.
Fran, thanks so much.
Paul Kelly, he's the Australian's editor-at-large and co-author of this new book. It's called The Truth and of the Palace Papers, Palace Letters rather, Deceit, Ambush and Dismissal in 1975. It's written by him and Troy Bramson and it's published by Melbourne University Press.